From New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic, this is Democracy Now!
Eu temo genocídio e quero denunciar essa coisa ao mundo inteiro.
I fear genocide. I want to denounce this thing to the whole world. We have here a government that does not care about the lives of the indigenous. It is a crime against humanity that is being practiced here in my state, here in my region.
As Brazil sees more than 800 deaths in 24 hours and nearly 400,000 confirmed cases, we look at COVID-19's devastating impact on Brazil's indigenous people, who are dying at double the rate of the rest of Brazil. The right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, a close Trump ally, called the virus a little flu. We'll speak with the world-renowned Brazilian photojournalist Sebastião Salgado, who wrote an open letter to Bolsonaro that warns the pandemic is an extreme threat to their very survival. Then to New Zealand, which implemented one of the earliest lockdowns and has largely succeeded in eliminating the coronavirus under the leadership of Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern.
Thank you for staying home and saving lives. Together, we have kept the virus under control and played our part to avoid the widespread devastation we've seen overseas. But I know it's at times been really tough. So thank you for all the sacrifices you've made over the past few months.
We'll go to Wellington, New Zealand, to speak with an epidemiologist advising the government on its response to COVID-19. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the quarantine report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. death toll from the coronavirus outbreak is fast approaching 100,000. As lockdowns ease across the United States and other countries around the World Health Organization's warning of a second peak of coronavirus cases. The WHO urged countries to step up testing and tracking. Across the globe, the pandemic has killed over 345,000 people, but that's believed to be an undercount. The New York Times marked the staggering U.S. death toll by dedicating its entire front page Sunday to hundreds of the names of Americans who died from the virus. President Trump spent parts of the Memorial Day weekend playing golf and using his Twitter account to attack his political enemies, spread conspiracy theories, and amplify the messages of some of his racist followers. He retweeted multiple personal attacks on how leader Nancy Pelosi and former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams, attacking Pelosi's physical appearance and Abrams' weight. He also reposted a tweet referring to Hillary Clinton as a skank. On Memorial Day, the president refused to wear a mask during events at Arlington Cemetery and Fort Henry. Meanwhile, he shared a tweet mocking Joe Biden for wearing a mask while visiting a veterans' memorial in Delaware. On Friday, North Dakota's Republican governor, Doug Burgum, made an emotional plea asking residents to avoid what he called mask shaming.
If somebody wants to wear a mask, there should be no mask shaming. You should look at them and say, that person's wearing a mask because for them, there's additional risk in their life.
Trump is threatening to move August Republican convention from Charlotte, North Carolina, if the state's Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, does not guarantee he can have a packed arena. On Monday, Trump accused Cooper of being, quote, still in shutdown mood. The Twitter attack came just 2 days after North Carolina registered its largest daily increase in coronavirus cases. On Friday, Trump said all houses of worship are essential and threatened to override governors who refused to lift restrictions on them if restrictions were not lifted by the weekend.
Some governors have deemed liquor stores and abortion clinics as essential, but have left out churches and other houses of worship. It's not right. So I'm correcting this injustice and calling houses of worship essential.
President Trump, however, does not have the authority to override state orders on places of worship. In immigration news, a Guatemalan man has become the second known person to die of the coronavirus while in the custody of ICE. That's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. 34-year-old Santiago Bathan Oshlag was imprisoned at the privately run Stewart Detention Center in Georgia before being transferred to a hospital. Earlier this month, another ICE prisoner, Carlos Ernesto Escobar Mejia of El Salvador, died in a San Diego hospital after becoming sick at the for-profit Otay Mesa Detention Center. On Sunday, immigrant rights activists drove by the Otay Mesa jail to demand the release of prisoners. This is protester Jennifer Frost Moreno.
No more needless or senseless deaths because of COVID-19 and ICE's lack of action to protect the detainees and staff inside detention centers.
At least 200 prisoners at Otay Mesa have reportedly contracted COVID-19. Nationwide, over 1,200 people at ICE jails have tested positive. In other immigration news, ICE is moving ahead with plans to deport more Haitian immigrants amidst the pandemic, including people who've tested positive for COVID-19. At least 9 people with the virus are set to be deported today, among 78 other Haitian nationals. One passenger on the deportation flight is Death Squad leader Emmanuel Toto Constant, who founded a paramilitary group that's been accused of rape, torture, and the murder of thousands of supporters of the overthrown former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Haitian activists are calling on the Department of Homeland Security to halt his deportation. President Trump's imposed new travel restrictions on Brazil as the World Health Organization's declared South America to be the new epicenter of the pandemic. Most foreign nationals who've been to Brazil in the last 14 days will not be allowed to enter the U.S. The order, which goes into effect just before midnight tonight, doesn't apply to U.S. citizens, permanent residents, or their close relatives. On Monday, Brazil's daily death toll topped 800, surpassing the U.S. daily total of 620. Brazil now has around 375,000 confirmed cases of the coronavirus, second only to the United States. Over 23,000 deaths have been reported. The Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, repeatedly dismissed concerns over the pandemic and clashed with local leaders over their efforts to curb the spread of the virus. We'll have more on Brazil and the devastation caused by the coronavirus in the Amazon. After headlines, we'll be speaking with renowned photojournalist Basto Salgado. Meanwhile, Chilean President Sebastian Piñera warned Chile's healthcare system is, quote, very close to the limit as the number of confirmed coronavirus cases tops 74,000. Argentina and Peru have extended their lockdowns into June. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing resistance from some parents and teachers as he moves to reopen schools in a week. He also announced non-essential retail could resume business next month. Meanwhile, his top advisor, Dominic Cummings, has come under intense fire after he broke Britain's lockdown to visit his parents while Cummings and his wife had active cases of COVID-19. Russia recorded its highest daily death toll Sunday with over 150 deaths, but says the number of new cases appears to be declining. The World Health Organization has suspended testing of hydroxychloroquine to treat COVID-19 amidst possible safety concerns. The antimalarial drug has been repeatedly touted by President Trump, who last week elicited shock and condemnation by claiming he's been taking hydroxychloroquine preventively. A new study in The Lancet that looked at over 96,000 hospitalized patients found those who were given hydroxychloroquine had a significantly higher death rate than those who did not. In Pakistan, 97 people died Friday when a Pakistan International Airlines jet crashed into a crowded, poor neighborhood of Karachi while attempting to land at the city's airport. 2 people survived the crash. Dozens of residents who live near the crash site were transported to the hospital, but no fatalities were reported on the ground. This is Salah Uddin, a resident of the Karachi neighborhood where the plane crashed.
It is a very tragic incident that has occurred on the occasion of Eid. It is especially painful because people were coming home to celebrate Eid with their loved ones. In a way, we can say the poor people have become martyrs. It is very sad.
The Washington Post is reporting the Trump administration recently discussed conducting the first U.S. nuclear test explosion since 1992. One official told the paper the test could help the U.S. in nuclear negotiations with Russia and China. But Daryl Kimball of the Arms Control Association warned the move, quote, would be the starting gun to an unprecedented nuclear arms race, unquote. Last week, the Trump administration announced its withdrawing from the Open Skies Treaty, a major international arms control deal. Last year, Trump also withdrew from the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, with Russia. In Hong Kong, thousands took to the streets Sunday to protest the new security laws proposed by China Friday, which they say will further tighten Beijing's grip on the semi-autonomous territory by cracking down on, quote, subversion of state power and secessionist activities. Police deployed tear gas, pepper spray and water cannons against the pro-democracy protesters. Critics say the new law, which will bypass the Hong Kong legislature, would mark an end to any independence held by the region. The Department of Justice is reportedly investigating the killing of Ahmaud Arbery as a hate crime. The Arbery family attorney, Lee Merritt, shared the news Monday. Ahmaud Arbery's case has drawn nationwide outrage after video emerged showing two white men chasing after the 25-year-old black man as he was jogging, then shooting him to death. No arrests were made until the video came to light 2 months later, earlier this month, even though the murder took place in February. A third white man who filmed the killing has also been arrested. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has apologized after facing backlash for telling radio host Charlemagne the God he, quote, ain't black if he was unsure about who to support in the upcoming election. Biden made the comment on the popular show The Breakfast Club Friday.
You got more questions, but I tell you, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or Trump, and you ain't black.
It don't have nothing to do with Trump. It has to do with the fact I want something for my community. I would love to see
you. Take a look at my record, man. I extended the voting rights 25 years. I have a record that is second to none. The NAACP has endorsed me every time I've run. Come on. Take a look at the record.
President Biden later apologized. And a federal judge in Florida has struck down a law requiring former felons pay court fines and fees before they can register to vote. U.S. District Court Judge Robert Hinkle said the law amounted to an unconstitutional poll tax. Republicans passed the law after Floridians approved a ballot measure in 2018 restoring voting rights for former felons. And Stacey Park Milburn, a beloved figure in the disability justice movement, has died at the age of 33 of complications from surgery. She started the Disability Justice Culture Club in her home in Oakland, California, as a place where queer, disabled, Black, Indigenous, and people of color could gather and organize. After the coronavirus pandemic hit, members of the group mobilized to make and distribute hand sanitizer and provide mutual aid to the community. Earlier this month, Stacey Park Milburn spoke out against an effort by hospital and assisted living lobbying groups in California to receive immunity from any kind of liability during the pandemic.
There has to be checks and balances on hospitals and nursing homes. Otherwise, disabled people, especially people of color, are left alone in a system that already doesn't care about us. Everything that we have right now in terms of community living and appropriate medical care didn't happen by itself. Disability rights advocates and racial justice advocates fought long and hard for it.
That was Stacey Park Milburn speaking earlier this month. She died last week on her 33rd birthday. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. When we come back, we look at COVID-19's devastating impact on Brazil's indigenous people who are dying at double the rate of the rest of Brazil. Juan Gonzalez and I will be speaking with world-renowned Brazilian photojournalist Sebastio Salgado, who wrote an open letter to right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro, warning the pandemic's an extreme threat to their very survival. Stay with us.
Em defesa de todas as favelas do meu Brasil, aqui fala o seu embaixador. Sim, mas a favela nunca foi reduto de marca.
valeu. A favela nunca foi reduto de marginal. Só tem gente humilde e marginalizada, e essa verdade não sai no jornal. A favela é um problema social. A favela é um problema social. É, mas eu sou favela e posso falar de cadeira. Minha gente é trabalhadeira e nunca teve assistência social. Sim, mas só vive lá, porque para o pobre não tem outro jeito. Apenas só tem o direito a um salário de fome e uma vida normal.
A favela é um problema social.
Certíssimo.
A favela é um problema social.
Sim, mas a favela nunca foi reduto de marginal, diz aí. Só tem gente humilde e marginalizada, e essa verdade não sai no jornal.
A favela é...
Favela by Beceta da Silva. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York City, one of the epicenters of the pandemic, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez from his home in New Brunswick, New Jersey. New Jersey is a state with the second highest number of infections. Hi, Juan.
Good morning, Amy, and good day to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show with Brazil, where the coronavirus is rapidly spreading with nearly 400,000 confirmed cases and almost 23,500 deaths, making Brazil's outbreak the second worst in the world after the United States. On Monday, Brazil's daily death toll surpassed the U.S. for the first time, with 807 deaths in 24 hours. President Trump has suspended travel from Brazil to the United States, effective today, just before midnight. Despite this, right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro has continued to dismiss the severity of the virus. He's called it a little flu and spoke out against lockdowns imposed by governors and mayors. Two health ministers have left his cabinet in recent weeks over disagreements over the handling of the pandemic. On Sunday, just as Brazil became the number two hotspot for COVID-19 in the world, Bolsonaro greeted anti-lockdown protesters outside the presidential palace. He wore and then removed a face mask as he mixed with his supporters.
Are you ready? We are in Brasilia now to join a spontaneous demonstration of the people for democracy, for freedom. The people who really want Brazil to move forward. Freedom above all else.
This comes as the spread of coronavirus is devastating Brazil's indigenous population, who are dying at double the rate of the rest of the population of Brazil, according to advocates. The Articulation of Indigenous Peoples of Brazil says there have been at least 980 confirmed cases and 125 deaths of indigenous people, indicating a mortality rate of 12.6% compared to 6.4% nationally. The city of Manaus in Brazil's Amazon region has been hard hit by the virus with nearly 1,200 deaths. Last week, the mayor of Manaus accused the government of Jair Bolsonaro of intentionally allowing indigenous communities to die of COVID-19.
Eu temo genocídio.
I fear genocide, and I want to denounce this to the whole world. We have here a government that does not care about the lives of indigenous people. It is a crime against humanity that is being practiced here in my state, here in my region.
Well, for more, we go to Paris, France, where we're joined by the world-renowned Brazilian photojournalist Sebastio Salgado. He's also warned that the indigenous peoples in the Amazon face genocide if the Brazilian government does not take steps to protect them from the coronavirus outbreak. Earlier this month, Sebastio Salgado wrote an open letter to President Bolsonaro warning that the pandemic represents an extreme threat to their very survival. The petition has gathered nearly 300,000 signatures. Sebastián Salgado has spent almost four decades documenting the Amazon and its people, and it is an honor to welcome you to Democracy Now!, Sebastián. Thank you so much for joining us. Can you talk about what you see happening in your home country, in Brazil, right now?
Well, Brazil now is living a very difficult moment. We have a central power held by President Bolsonaro that is not acting in the normal way that every country acts around the world to handle the coronavirus. And we have the governors of the states, the mayors of the big cities that are taking care, putting people in quarantine, and Mr. Bolsonaro is working in the opposite way. And that's creating an amazing destabilization of the country. I am very concerned with the Indian community, mostly the Amazonia. I just finished a bond of work where I spent 7 years in Amazonia. And these Indians have no immunological protection against the diseases that come out of the forest. The government knows this. Everyone knows this. And we are not taking care. We must take care to protect these Indians. The country will be real a genocide.
And Sebastião Salgado, you have said in the past that you believe that the virus is a product of the destruction of the planet's environment. Could you elaborate on that?
No, ask me again what the question exactly.
That in the past you have said that the coronavirus pandemic is in part a product of the destruction of the environment around the planet.
Well, you see, we are destroying every portion of the ecosystem protectors of this planet. And we are putting the diseases that will be possible to stay inside this protected environment out of the environments. And that's a very difficult moment that we are living. Probably what is happening now in all the planets around the world will be bring us to mind more about environment, to come back to our planet, to protect what we have the pristine, and to see how we can rebuild the ecosystem in order that we can live in peace with our planet is what happens everywhere around the world.
Let me ask you, I wanted to turn to the chief of Três Unidos. It's an indigenous village in Brazil's Amazon rainforest that I'm sure you know well, where the coronavirus infected people despite a lockdown to all outside visitors. At least 16 of the village's 106 people have tested positive for COVID-19. The virus likely came up the Rio Negro River from Manaus, which is 5 hours away. This is the village chief, Aldemir da Silva.
This virus is treacherous. It came quietly, as if carried on the wind. We started getting ill and thought it was a bad cold, but people got worse even after taking medicine made at home and taking antibiotics and anti-inflammatory medicine. We managed to treat the illness in a careful way.
If you could talk, Sebastião Salgado, about how the indigenous people are now dealing and how the government is dealing with them. I mean, you have this battle going on in Manaus with the mayor calling the president stupid. If you can talk about the history of the way indigenous people are dealt with in the Amazon.
You see, when Brazil was discovered, today the scientists can calculate that the population of Brazilian Amazonian ecosystem, we had about 5 million people living there. With the diseases come from outside, a lot of Indians disappear. Today we have just a little bit more than 300,000 Indians living in Amazonia. A lot of them are close to the cities as Manaus, as Barcelos, São Gabriel, as you said, these Indians are contacted after a long time, and they have more anticorps. They are more adapted for the world, urban world. But one very big portion of the Brazilian tribes are quite isolated tribes. You see, only Brazilian Amazonians who have a little bit more than 100 groups that we are never contacted. They are completely isolated, the Indians. And the diseases coming inside of Amazonia can hit them. You see, what is happening now, the danger, is that Mr. Bolsonaro took all the filters to protect the ecosystem, eliminating all the institutions, weakening the institutions that protected the Amazonas ecosystem. And he took out of most of the budget of the National Foundation of the Indians. And what happens? After a while, the Amazonian protect land of the Indian territory started to be invaded by loggers, by gold diggers, by religious groups. Only in Yanomami territory in Amazonia, we have today, in this moment that we are speaking, more than 22,000 gold diggers that are invading the territory. And these people are carrying the disease inside. What we apply with this letter to the president of Brazil is to stop, to push out these invaders, to create a kind of a barrier, sanitary barrier, people come inside the Indian territory in order to protect the tribes. The contrary, we lose them. They will disappear. They have no anticorps, antibody to protect themselves against this disease.
And Sebastião Salgado, what does it mean to have a president like Jair Bolsonaro, who basically ridicules science, doesn't pay attention to his own public health officials, very similar to some of the stuff that's happening here in the United States with President Trump, but even worse? What does it mean not only for the Amazon and the indigenous population, but for all Brazilians?
You see, the big problem is President Bolsonaro, that he is destroying the Brazilian institutions. Brazil had very good institutions, cultural, health institutions, the protection of Indian territory. He's extremist, rightist president. He's destroying these institutions. He's trying to make the Indians that live in that territory, that are hunters, that are gatherers, they wanted to transform them in peasants. It's incredible. It's incompatible. And he's no respecting all these territories protected by law. And that is happening at every level of the Brazilian society. We are living a very difficult moment in Brazil.
I'm wondering if you could talk, Sebastião Salgado, on the attacks on the truth, both from the president of Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, who is a very close ally of the president of the United States, President Trump. Both of them diminished to the end this coronavirus. The president of Brazil, of course, calling it a little flu. President Trump saying it would come to nothing, 15 cases and then zero, as opposed to what so many of the scientific advisors around him were telling him. Now, you are famous in your work for photographing, documenting the truth of people on the ground all over the world, particularly workers, indigenous people. Your famous book, Migrations, Humanity and Transition, Workers and Archaeology of the Industrial Age, Gold and Terra Struggle, the struggle of the landless. Can you talk about this phenomenon that we see, if you can call lies that, the thousands of lies told by these men that clearly take lives, and particularly of the most vulnerable?
You see, we have countries. We have very poor population. Countries with more populated than Brazil, than the United States. If you take India, if you take Indonesia, These countries, they take care of the population. They had one quarantine, and they are come out now from the quarantine with a lot of deaths, but not enormous amount as the United States, as the Brazil. It's exactly these two presidents that don't care about their people. They care about money, about rentability. I put myself the question, if you are a government, we are a government for the people of your nation, your country. You are not a president just for the profit. And that is the big problem happens in this moment. The United States has the biggest number of deaf people in the world by coronavirus. You are just today crossed 100,000 deaths in the United States. In Brazil, because the figures are not good, we are telling that you have more than 20,000, just more than 20,000 people, because the ones that die inside the hospitals, that we can identify that they die by coronavirus. But the people that die in the slums, the people that are in very poor areas, we don't know of about they are dying. The scientists in Brazil calculated that we must have minimum 9 times more cases and deaths in Brazil than just the official figures that is present.
And Sebastião Salgado, you mentioned the thousands of gold diggers that are invading the Amazon, but there are also major multinational companies, major Brazilian companies, that are also benefiting from these policies of Jair Bolsonaro. Could you talk about who some of these companies are so that people know?
Well, the companies, yes, but you see, Bolsonaro was elected by the agribusiness in Brazil and by the sectarian religious groups. And he's open the Amazon territory, most for farmers, for loggers, for gold diggers. You see, we spoke a lot last year about the fires in Amazonia in last July, August. This year will be worse. We are destroying the forest in a very high speed, and we are destroying everywhere around Amazonia. These farmers, they are growing the space by the incentive of the president. The companies, of course, that they are there. They are trying to get what they can have in this government. But the big problem is the populism of Mr. Bolsonaro, that he wanted to have voters that have his mind in the new elections, and he is giving Amazonia for the people that want to invade it. And you have hundreds of thousands invading Amazonia. As I said a few minutes ago, only gold diggers inside Yanomami territory. We have more than 22,000. But we have loggers going inside everywhere. Farmers destroy the forest everywhere. It's a general problem, and it's not just specific of big companies. They are also inside the problem. And the biggest problem is the populism of the president.
If you can talk about this Reuters report that says that the Brazilian environment minister, Ricardo Salles, called on the government to push through further deregulation of environmental policy while people are distracted by the coronavirus. In a video the Supreme Court ordered released, the video of the minister's meeting surfaced an investigation of whether President Bolsonaro interfered in appointing leaders of the federal police for personal gain. During the meeting, other ministers spoke, including Salles, with environmental groups, saying his remarks prove Bolsonaro government is systematically seeking to dismantle environmental protections.
You see, we have enough happens in Brazil to have an impeachment of this president. Everything that the ministers are doing, they are doing in the way to take the power. They are doing every weekend in the meetings that they do in Brazil a proposition to have the power in their hands out of the democratic way. They are applying for a coup d'etat. And you see, we are living a difficult moment because how you can do an impeachment during this big problem of coronavirus? Who will be putting in place? How will we have new elections in a month like this? And they are profiting. They are taking profit for themselves in order to made more larger that power. The example you just gave a few minutes ago, the Minister of Environment, Mr. Salas, doing the proposition that just in this moment that you are completely toward the coronavirus was the moment to push all the destruction of the law system that protects the Indian communities, that protect the environment, that protect the destruction of the rainforest. He tried to destroy all this now in order to create a total destabilization in the order in Brazil. Brazil has a fantastic system of law. The National Foundation of Indians is one amazing institution. Who directs the National Foundation of Indians now is no more an anthropologist, like always was, a scientific that always was. Now is a cop, is a policeman that is directing the National Foundation of Indians. National Foundation of Indians now is not acting more for the Indians. They are acting for the farmers. The order is completely reversed in Brazil.
And Sebastián Salgado, you've said clearly that the key role that farmers are playing, Brazil is a big exporter of agricultural products. What kind of pressure could governments around the world exercise on Brazil? Do you support some sanctions against the Bolsonaro government to make them take the necessary steps that to protect indigenous communities?
I believe that the political sanctions, political pressure, Brazil is very sensitive for outside of the country. Brazil is a big exporter of raw material, and I believe that we can do pressure. I don't apply to do interdiction of importation of Brazilian goods because the Brazilians need to leave. I'm not applying from this, but I'm applying for the political pressure in companies that invest in Brazil, that they put rollers in their investment, that they take care of the environment, that they accept to finance in Brazil if the Brazilian, the Brazilian government respect the minimum of the environment that is not happening in Brazil now. I believe that the pressure must be a very hard political and economical pressure.
Sebastião, can you talk about Messias Martins Cocama, an indigenous leader in Parque de Tribos, a region of Manaus state made up of 3,000 people from at least 37 different ethnic tribes? He died of COVID-19 earlier this month. This is local indigenous resident, Vandelecia Ortega dos Santos, wearing a mask that says, Indigenous Lives Matter.
Here we still have this dream of quality education and health because we have not yet been provided with assistance. His death is also representative of what's lacking, a lack of health care, of what's missing for those indigenous who live in the city.
If you can talk about this area, Manaus, and talk about what has happened to the people as well, and what you're calling for in this letter signed by 300,000 people that has gotten a tremendous amount of attention among the people who have signed it are Oprah Winfrey and Madonna, Naomi Campbell, the author Mario Vargas Llosa, the artist Ai Weiwei, actors Meryl Streep, Brad Pitt, and others.
Well, our hope, this letter was not directed exclusively to the president of Brazil. We directed this letter to the legislative, to the executive power, the president, to the legislative power, and to the judiciary power. We are applying this three power to add us is a humanitarian letter. We are not made any political attack to the government of Mr. Bolsonaro. We are applying for a humanitarian actor to protect these tribes. You see, Amy, in Amazonia, in Brazil, we have these Indians, as I said a few minutes ago, that were never contacted. These Indians are the prehistory of the humanity. We are a species that are living with the prehistory of, we are living with our past inside Amazonia, and we are in total danger to lose all this population now. And the coronavirus multiply very fast. If they go inside these communities are linked one to each other. And we be very complicated. We are applying to protect these more isolated groups, to create a barrier, to not to take out the invaders and create a barrier, not allow the people come inside this territory for a while to protect this population. The reply in Brazil of this petition, of this letter, was very, very good. We have all Brazilian press. We had all the newspapers that gave the notice. And we are having, we continue to have meetings with the judges, with the group of the judiciary system in Brazil to see if we can create this humanitarian protection for the Indians.
Finally, Sebastio, if you could comment more broadly on the future of Brazil. You fled Brazil in 1969. You fled the military dictatorship there. You went to Paris. If you can talk about the future of Brazil and also your own time now, just like we here are sheltering in place in the United States, you have too. I last saw you years ago when we had this amazing conversation in New Mexico, a public conversation with Eduardo Galeano as well, you may remember. And you were talking about your son then, but you're living with your son with Down syndrome. You've written about that as well. It's a lot of questions there. The future of Brazil to what you're doing now.
You see, Amy, Brazil, when I was a child in Brazil, we had more than 90% of Brazilian population that were rural population. Now we must be more than 90% urban population. In very few, in few decades, four, five, 6 decades maximum, we made what you in the United States, the European, made 300, 400 years to urbanize. And we have a lot of problems that were linked to this massive movement of population toward of the urban sector in Brazil. Brazil, we had a dictatorship in Brazil. Today, we have a democratic system. And we are in evolution. It's not easy, the things happening in Brazil. We are one of the biggest countries in the world. We are the fifth population in the world. We are the fifth biggest country in the world. Brazil is an important country. And I have a big hope that the disaster that we are living now with Mr. Bolsonaro is just temporary, that this is just a step in our evolution, that we can become a real equilibrated socially in the economic country.
And finally, you're living in Paris right now, sheltering in place like we are, and you spending more time with your son.
Yes, I live here. We came to Paris, as you said, in 1969. I came here in this time. I were an economist. I came here to prepare a PhD in economics. And we stay here during the dictatorship. And we have a Down syndrome child that born here, that grows here. And I became a photographer here. I travel all over the world. We work a lot in Brazil. The farm of my parents, we transform in a national park. This farm, the hand forest was completely destroyed. With Lelia, my wife, we replanted this forest. We planted now more to 2,700,000 trees. We create one of the biggest environmental institutions in Brazil. And we keep working, we keep going in Brazil. I'm a living part in France because my professional photographer. I developed it here, but I keep working environment in Brazil. We are in Brazil all the time.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Sebastião Salgado, world-renowned Brazilian photojournalist who has spent almost four decades documenting the Amazon and the people who live there. Salgado has been a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador since 2001, has traveled to more than 100 countries for his photojournalism, some of which has been compiled in his books, including Migrations, Humanity in Transition, and Workers, an Archaeology of the Industrial Age, Gold and Terra, Struggle of the Landless. We will also link to that conversation that we had together back in 2000 in New Mexico, a conversation I had with Sebastião Salgado and Eduardo Galeano, the great Uruguayan writer who has since passed. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to New Zealand, as the U.S. deals with the greatest catastrophe in history. We look back at one of the earliest lockdowns that has largely succeeded in eliminating the coronavirus. It happened in New Zealand under the leadership of Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Stay with us. Zealand musician Chris Knox. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to New Zealand, which implemented one of the earliest lockdowns in response to the pandemic, has largely succeeded in eliminating the coronavirus after the number of infections peaked in April. There was just a single confirmed COVID-19 case reported in New Zealand last week. This comes as a 5.8 magnitude earthquake struck the capital, Wellington, Monday, while Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was in the middle of a live TV interview.
We're just having a bit of an earthquake here, Ryan. Quite a decent shake here, but if you see things moving behind me, the beehive moves a little more than most. Yep, no, it's just stopped.
Starting last week, Prime Minister Ardern began transitioning New Zealand, a Pacific nation that's home to more than 5 million people, from lockdown level 3 to level 2, allowing most shops, restaurants, schools and workplaces to reopen. Some of the country's success has been attributed to Ardern's leadership, trust in science and clear communication during the crisis. Instead of launching a war, she urged people to unite against COVID-19 and often calls the country, quote, our team of 5 million. In March, after putting her 21-month-old daughter to bed, Ardern hosted a Facebook Live session from her couch as New Zealanders submitted questions.
Excuse the casual attire. Can be a messy business putting toddlers to bed, so I'm not in my work clothes. But some of the key things that I've been asked about are things like, you know, can we go for a walk? Penny, you've asked, you've got four children, can you walk with all of them or should you just take two at a time? You can walk with the people that you will be with for the next month, for the people that you're living with. You can walk with them. They're your... the people that will be in your life consistently over this period of time, and you can walk with them. But if when you're walking, you pass by someone, keep your distance, keep 2 meters between everyone. I imagine New Zealanders are going to be doing a lot of long distance waving while we're out and about.
That was Jacinda Ardern in March. On Sunday, the Prime Minister thanked her nation for staying home during the COVID-19 pandemic to break the chain of transmission and save lives.
Thank you for staying home and saving lives. Together, we have kept the virus under control and played our part to avoid the widespread devastation we've seen overseas. But I know it's at times been really tough. So thank you for all the sacrifices you've made over the past few months. From the children who missed out on precious time with their grandparents to the families who've had to say goodbye to loved ones from afar. New Zealanders have given up a lot to keep each other safe.
Well, for more, we go to Wellington, New Zealand, where we're joined by Dr. Michael Baker, professor of public health at the University of Otago. He's an epidemiologist, a member of the New Zealand Ministry of Health's Technical Advisory Group. He's been advising Prime Minister Ardern on the response to COVID-19. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Thank you for staying up so late. I'm holding the New York Times front page of this weekend, U.S. deaths near 100,000, an incalculable loss, the whole front page lists hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of names. We have something under 5% of the population, but more than a quarter of the deaths in the world. Can you talk about what New Zealand can teach not only the United States, Brazil, and other far more populous countries, but what you recognized early on and what you did, Dr. Baker?
Well, greetings from Wellington. It's a great pleasure to be on your program. I think there are several lessons when you look across the globe at how different countries have responded. But I think one of the main messages is to respond decisively and have that combination of good science and good leadership. And countries that have succeeded have done this. And in the case of New Zealand, we had the same pandemic plan as many other countries, which was a good plan, but it was for a different virus. It was for influenza. And by late February, we realized this was more like a SARS virus, so we had to change our direction very rapidly. And I think across the Western world, there was this idea of complacent exceptionalism, that somehow the virus might behave differently when it hit the Western world compared with how it was in Asia. But in fact, we looked to Asia for examples of a good approach. And for example, the way China contained the virus and other Asian countries were managing it, we realized that elimination was possible. So we changed direction very quickly.
And Dr. Baker, this whole issue of in most of the advanced West, the focus has been on flattening the curve or mitigating the virus. Could you talk about that discussion that went on in those early days about trying to eliminate it completely?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I mean, the approach for dealing with influenza pandemics is a mitigation one. You cannot contain it. So basically, the wave is going to wash over you. And the strategy is all about, as you say, flattening the curve, reducing demand on the healthcare system and not overwhelming it, trying to protect the most vulnerable. So we're very familiar with those approaches. But when we looked at the success of mainland China and also Taiwan in particular with actually preventing the virus, stopping it at the borders, and also doing contact tracing to stamp out cases, we changed tack very quickly. And so you do things in a different order if you realize that. You actually throw everything at the pandemic early on. So at the point that we had 100 cases, no fatalities, and around the 23rd of March, a decision was made to go for this elimination approach. And that meant putting the whole country into a very intense lockdown for the best part of 6 weeks. And that did three things. It basically stamped out chains of transmission because the whole country was effectively in home quarantine. It also enabled us to build up a lot of capabilities that we really didn't have at that point, and that was to do a lot of testing, a lot of contact tracing, and also improve our border quarantine. And the third thing it did, it basically just explained to the whole country what physical distancing was all about, because we'd never experienced a pandemic before. We were barely affected by SARS. And so at the end of that, it's a pretty harsh approach, but at the end of that, there was very little virus being transmitted in New Zealand. So we're now coming out of lockdown by degrees. And it's very different from coming out of lockdown overseas because we're trying to come down into a virus-free New Zealand. And the evidence now, based on a huge amount of testing that we're doing, is that there is not circulating virus in New Zealand. We're just getting the very, very tail end of some of the outbreaks.
And could you talk about some of the particularities of New Zealand, number one, being an island nation, to what degree that helped in your being able to stamp out the virus, and also the role of your healthcare system, to what degree that made it easier or more difficult to deal with the pandemic?
Yeah, well, being an island, it's much easier to manage your borders, and really, that's the number one thing you have to do. But actually, some countries with huge borders, like mainland China, in fact, Vietnam, Mongolia, appear to be succeeding very well with the same elimination approach. So it doesn't you don't have to be an island. And of course, many Pacific islands have taken an even more extreme approach. They just, if you like, lifted the drawbridge entirely and have excluded the virus. So it's not a necessity to be an island. The second point about the healthcare system, I think it helps to have a socialized health system because obviously you can deliver testing more easily, you can manage your hospitals more effectively. And so I think that's helped in Australia and New Zealand, and I guess also in some Asian countries that have a highly centralized healthcare system.
And can you talk about what you see the U.S. has done wrong? I mean, it's just astounding. The richest country in the world is the epicenter of this pandemic. And if you can also talk about the racial disparities that we've seen, particularly African Americans, far more greater death toll than their population in the United States should be, very disproportionate. What happened in New Zealand with the Maori, with the indigenous population, with low-income New Zealanders? Most importantly, what do you think the U.S. is doing wrong?
Yeah, well, firstly, looking at the inequalities, unfortunately, that seems to be a feature of pandemics and infectious disease in general, as they magnify social inequalities. And with our current government, inequalities is one of the central driving concerns with the healthcare system and with the pandemic response. So equity has been a major driver. It was also one of the reasons we have put, obviously, a huge amount of resources into the elimination approach, because the most pro-equity thing we can do is to keep the virus out, and that is the situation now. When I look at the United States, obviously I'm very disappointed, or more than disappointed, because it is a tragic situation. And usually for leadership, we look to the US, particularly the Centers for Disease Control. We look to the UK, Public Health England. And with this, and also the World Health Organization, unfortunately, I think there was a severe error of judgment in assessing this pandemic, because there was a period when it was containable, but the advice was not to shut borders, and there was a complacent attitude. So I think that's the number one problem, is that our major health agencies in the Western world have really let us down, and I think governments as well, because this was an entirely preventable global catastrophe. So I think that's the number one requirement, is that science and leadership have to work together and recognize these threats and manage them accordingly.
And also, could you talk about the issue of the legitimacy of leadership in terms of being able to effectuate these kinds of severe or stringent policies? Obviously, in China, they have to call out the military to completely isolate Wuhan. But in New Zealand, you didn't really have to deal with any kind of major enforcement, per se. Could you talk about that in the few seconds we have left?
Yeah, I think really empathetic leadership, as we've seen in New Zealand, helps. But actually, Australia has got a different style of government, and they've also succeeded. But the best performing country on earth has actually been Taiwan, I think, because they acted very early. They didn't need a lockdown. And that was because they had a very strong public health agency, and they started managing their borders in January, and they did everything right. So I think they've had
Michael
a model
Baker,
response.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to continue with a post-show and post-online at democracynow.org. From New Zealand, I'm Amy Goodman, Ruben Gonzalez. Be safe.